Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Bill Burnett and Dave Evans to the broadcast. Bill and Dave are the co-authors of the New York Times best-selling book, Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived, Joyful Life, and the co-directors of the Stanford Life Design Lab. Bill is the executive director of the design program at Stanford. He directs the undergraduate and graduate programs in innovative design and is a consulting assistant professor. Bill has a Bachelor of Science and a Master of Science in Product Design from Stanford University. Dave is a lecturer in the product design program at Stanford and has served as an executive leadership and management consultant for high technology companies for over 25 years. He's also worked in alternative energy, led product marketing teams at Apple, and is a co-founder of Electronic Arts. Dave holds a Bachelor of Science and Master of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering from Stanford University and a graduate diploma in Contemplative Spirituality from the San Francisco Theological Seminary. I recently caught up with Dave and Bill from their office at the Stanford Life Design Lab at Stanford University, and we discussed the evolution of the Designing Your Life concept, the ideas and tools that are used in the program, the Designing Your Life for Women workshop, and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you'd give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. Fortinet, the global leader in high-performance cybersecurity solutions, is a proud sponsor of the Forum on World-Class IT. The Fortinet Security Fabric delivers the broad, powerful, and automated protections today's organizations require to secure their evolving networks, from IoT to the cloud. Learn more at fortinet.com. Bill Burnett and Dave Evans, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT. It's great to have you both here.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for inviting us. Yeah,
great pleasure. Bill, I thought I'd begin with you, if you don't mind. As the executive director of the design program at Stanford, knowing that the book that we'll be discussing and the program that both of you have led in designing your life, I thought we'd begin just with a definition of terms and the whole notion of the design program at Stanford, which is foundational to the work that the two of you have been doing. Can you give a quick overview?
You know, we've been teaching design as sort of a human-centered practice at Stanford for a long, long time. It started way back in 1957. In 1963, the Board of Trustees of Stanford gave us permission to give out this really unusual degree. Now, most people, when they hear the word design, they think of things like graphic design or industrial design, kind of a craft-based, skills-based design activity. And that's great. That's pretty commonly the way design is taught all over the place. Stanford took a little different tack. We had a couple of big thinkers involved in this, a guy from MIT named John Arnold and another guy named Bob McKinn. And they put together what we call human-centered design, which is sort of engineering plus psychology plus a little anthropology to try to understand people well, and then really leaning hard into this sort of creativity and ideation thing. So what we now call design thinking, which is a term David Kelly came up with, is this innovation methodology which relies on, you know, this kind of multiple set of tools and really focuses on human needs. So you could call it human-centered design. You could call it design thinking. It's a way of innovating in anything, a product, a service, designing experiences. That's primarily what we do here at Stanford, is teach undergraduates and graduates how to be design thinkers. They go out in the world. They work at all the big companies around here, Facebook and Google and Amazon, and then lots of major corporations, particularly IBM, for instance, has a huge program now to implement design thinking across their organization as their innovation strategy. So that's what I teach. The Designing Your Life class popped up as a little side project that's kind of gotten out of control. We're mostly teaching our students here who are in engineering school how to be innovators when they go out into industry.
Dave, I'd like to turn to you. As I read, the genesis of the Designing Your Life in the classroom 8 years ago
began with you taking Bill to lunch. Of course, that then led to the book, Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived, Joyful Life, recently come out. And I wonder, what was the problem you were looking to solve or the opportunity that you saw that led you to hook up with Bill and begin to collaborate?
This is an idea that just suddenly popped into my head slowly over 43 years. It starts back when I was a late teenager and a sophomore at Stanford myself, and getting really wrapped around the axle of the question, what do I want to do with my life? And I really was struggling with it. And I found most of the help I got from most of the people you would have thought would have been helpful. You know, I went to my mom, I went to my mom's friends, I went to the church, I went to the university in particular, and I found them all, frankly, very unhelpful, almost criminally negligently unhelpful. A lot of people wanted to help you go get what you wanted once you knew what it was, but people were not good at helping you figure out what it was you wanted. And I thought that seemed kind of criminal. So I was upset by it, but I couldn't solve that. And so I just, you know, like everybody else, did it the hard way. We'll fast forward many years. You know, I tried to solve the energy crisis 35 years too soon, ended up in high tech because I was in Silicon Valley. And there I was on the first corporate culture committee at Apple in 1978 or 79. And there began to realize, you know, that people in the workplace were asking the same question I was. Everybody's asking the same question. You know, what does this work mean to us? When we wrote the manifesto before the business plan at Electronic Arts, how to create the work environment that helps people become who they want to be, because that's how they're really going to engage and do their best work. And as I continued to try to answer my own question, as the poetess would say, what will you do with the rest of your one wild and precious life? I found everybody else is asking that too. So I'm finding myself having literally thousands of cups of coffee before work or a glass of wine or beer after, chatting about that with people, start, you know, teaching small seminars on the side about the stuff I've discovered, got invited to teach at Cal the year 2000, a class we titled Finding Your Vocation. And then it was after there a couple of years that, you know, when the D School got started at Stanford, and David Kelly, who's good at being two people, but not quite three, he could run IDEO and either the design program or this brand new institute at Stanford of design. He asked Bill to come in and lead the design program, which is how we got Bill as the executive director. When that happened, I went, Bill's an old colleague. Maybe he thinks this is interesting. We had lunch in 2007. And I said, hey, you know, this question's been plaguing me my entire life. I noticed it plagues just about everybody. The university still stinks at it. I've been teaching at Berkeley. This little class has gone surprisingly well, but we really ought to use design thinking to do this. And I think this is the kind of thing at least design students would like. What do you think? And Bill said, absolutely, let's go. We'll do it this fall. We'll prototype it this summer. 5 minutes later, we're down the road. Literally a 43-year story kind of zoomed forward. That's how we got there. And then we started teaching just the design students, called a class for the designers. It was called The Designer's Voice. How do you find your professional voice as a designer, the way that an author would or a thespian would? And then the university asked us, couldn't you do this for everybody? We said, sure, we'll give that a try. And then as soon as we opened up Designing Your Life to the entire student body, the thing kind of blew up in our hands. And now we're here on the phone talking to you.
You know, one of the things I found so interesting about the book is that you take these sort of shibboleths, if you will, dysfunctional beliefs, you refer to them as, kind of discredit them. I took that as almost like the ideas that are in everyone's head. I won't list them exhaustively, but your degree determines your career. If you're successful, you'll be happy. It's too late. I should know where I'm going. Basically, what you're, if I may, it seemed, attempting to do is to say, look, most of us believe that we're, most of us are in some way, shape, or form on some kind of ladder, one that has rungs that, you know, there's a role we're in, there's a role above us, we're looking towards ways perhaps to get to the one that's next. And I read a lot of the book to say, wait a second, you need to recognize that there are other ladders you could be climbing. In fact, they may be better ones for you. Some of the advice that you offer, advice like be curious and try stuff and reframe problems, know it's a process, ask for help. A lot of it is taking the traditional constraints, the dysfunctional beliefs, instead begin to unconstrain yourself as to the kinds of things that you really would make you happy, and then designing a career or a set of activities around that. Bill, is that a sort of a fair synopsis?
I think it really is. And I liked your description of multiple ladders. In design, when you're designing a product or something, you never just have one idea. That would be terrible. You always want to generate lots and lots of ideas. And there's lots of research, and we're pretty research-based in the book, which says if you start with three ideas and you generate ideas from there, you'll have a better set of ideas. You'll have a better chance to choose into something that's more successful. And so it's the same thing with your life. There isn't one ladder. There isn't just the thing you're doing and then the next thing. And oftentimes people find themselves so almost trapped. We've been doing workshops all around the country, and we've been talking to people, and a lot of times people who are very successful, you know, they did climb that ladder, they got to be partner at the law firm or an executive at their company, have found that they're unhappy, and they feel trapped because they just thought it was a singular one size fits all. First of all, people grow and change. Second of all, there's not just one solution to your life. There's many, many solutions. They're not even a problem, really. It's just an adventure. And this notion that if I don't find the right thing, or if I don't launch exactly into the right career out of school, I'm kind of screwed, or I'll be late, or something bad will happen. There's just no evidence that that's true. And there's tons of evidence in social stage theory and other things that you're going to have multiple careers, multiple expressions of your life. And that's what's going to make it fun. Dave and I always tell the students, do you really want your 22-year-old telling your 45-year-old what he's going to be doing for a living? I mean, that's crazy. You don't know anything at 22. To imagine it more as an exploration, we call it the odyssey. You do three plans, not one, three odyssey plans, three ideations for your life. That really tends to break things open for people. And then they discover all sorts of stuff that's out there that is actually available for them to try. And it's a much more interesting approach than this sort of singular ladder. I just got to get the next thing and then I'll be happy. And then I'm not happy, so I have to get the next thing, and on and on and on. People can really get trapped by that. Kind of, there's a sense of accomplishment in climbing the ladder. But if it's not something, you know, that ultimately you find interesting or fulfilling, it's going to be empty when you get to the top.
Let me piggyback on that, Peter, if I may. The first question was about design thinking in our class and the way we apply that to life design. We claim very few things. You know, we do not promise an epiphany, or that your life will be solved, or that we have magic, that you can suddenly make the universe entirely organized around your happiness. We don't have any of those tools. You have all the resources you need. You need better tools to get at them. And we say, we only give you two things. We give you ideas and tools. And the ideas are alternate ways to think, and the tools are things you can do. You know, you build your way forward. We have a bias to action. You don't analyze your way forward. You don't think your way out of this problem. You act your way out of this problem. And that's it. If you scan through all of our ideas and you scan through all of our tools, then you pick the ideas you think have merit and you pick the tools that have merit, because you'll throw some away that don't work for you. And you actually use them, you're going to be a little better off. That's actually the only promise we make. And the first thing you zeroed in on is what we call reframes. Almost all the ideas are a reframe. Did you notice you were thinking this? Hey, college student, did you notice everybody told you when you went to college, these are the best 4 years of your life? Of course, means after 22, it's all downhill for the next 65 years, which is a terrible idea. Because all questions and all shibboleths, as you call them, have a point of view, have a little belief system. In design thinking, we start with empathy, which is deeply understand the situation we're in. And the first thing to do is take a look at, did you notice what you decided you're believing now about the way things are? And be very careful about the questions you decide to organize your life with. And then if you reframe them, you can really change the game. The number one thing we hear from people is relief and freedom when they read the book, because we're just saying things that they kind of suspected and are now giving themselves permission to think more freely on. Even your question, gee, there are different ladders. Well, if I was going to look at that empathetically, I'd go, gosh, I noticed, Peter, that apparently you think life is organized around ladders and it's about going up. How about not which ladder am I on, but how about which dance floor am I on? Which painting canvas am I currently painting on? We got to be very careful about the way we frame our question. So we're just trying to give people some freedom and some perspective on that, and it really frees up the territory.
Reading this as somebody who's multiple decades into my own career, but knowing that the genesis of this was designed for people who were in their early 20s, I'd be interested in the feedback you've been getting from readers, who I have to imagine maybe also many of them in their 20s, but no doubt a lot more of them who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and beyond. And you make the point that it's never too late, that it doesn't matter what age you are. I'm curious, though, the kinds of conversations and insights you're getting that are different from the people that originally those benefited from your insights, from your collaboration in the classroom, those who are largely in their 20s, versus now to a much greater extent with people who are later in their career. Can you share a bit of perspectives? Again, maybe Bill, maybe starting with you.
We've had the privilege of going around 16 cities. The Stanford Alumni Association has us going around doing little mini workshops with alums. And so we are meeting a lot of people in their 30s and 40s, and also kind of in their mid-50s, 60s, looking at what people are now calling their encore career. And I noticed you had done an interview with the guy who was the CIO and the innovation officer at the AARP.
Yes.
We did a little talk with the AARP thought leaders about this as well. And what we're finding is the ideas that kind of unlock the space and give you a chance to reframe and come up with new things, those are all the same. And the tools all work. But people have really kind of different issues that come up. You know, when you're in your 30s, it's kind of, you know, you're forming a family maybe, and now it's a work-life balance thing. And what about kids? And what about my primary relationship? How does that and work go together? The book is called Designing Your Life, Not Designing Your Career. And so we really do care about all the other things that aren't just work. And then people we meet in their 50s and 60s are moving from what people are now saying, they're moving from their money-making side of their life to the meaning-making side. If you look at the stages in lives when people have these sort of big career or life decisions to make, certainly, you know, the high school to college transition, and the big one is college to the world. But, you know, in your 30s, you've got all the questions about work and life and family and how that's going to play out. And people often, you know, in their 40s are pivoting at their first career. Maybe it was satisfying, but they're just bored and they want to try something new. Maybe it just didn't turn out to be what they thought it would be. At all of those little points along the way, these tools are really kind of power tools to help you figure out what's next.
Mm-hmm. Please, yes, Dave.
You said, understandably, you know, we developed this for college students. Well, sort of. Again, you know, the course really emanates out of the 30 plus years of attempts at self-awareness that both Bill and I have been laboring at. And we both did a lot of work in the consulting field. I did a lot of management consulting, Bill did a lot of design consulting, where you sit down with people who are trying to figure something out. And so an awful lot of the insights we ran into as people were conversing with us and we were experiencing how human beings were struggling with the question of becoming their better selves was with working people during our career lives, our second or third careers. We're both on, I think, our fifth careers now. The formative ideas, that long empathetic stroll we took through adult life that landed, you know, in 2007 on let's do this thing for a bunch of college kids, we found that fundamental human challenge of what do I do with the rest of my life is really the same. And the fundamental approach that requires an open-minded experimentalism as opposed to some kind of pre-concluded analytic orientation is true across the board. So the first time we brought it to the fore, the first time we fully implemented the design thinking model into it, you know, was opportunistically this place called Stanford that just happened to have a whole bunch of people ask the question about 20 hours a day, what am I going to do? A really good place to start. But the essence of this was really a human problem, not just a 20-something problem. So we get asked all the time, aren't you guys really focusing on the young adult? And we like to reframe that question. So gosh, what you're really saying, Peter, is gosh, Bill and Dave, you talk to people of lots of ages. At what age have you noticed people don't really care about this question anymore and they're just waiting to die? And, you know, they don't really care. And we have not found that age yet. At the first one of those 16 events for Stanford, we're in front of a room of 400 people in New York, and front and center was a young woman from the class of 1953, 87 years old, and she could not wait to get started. I mean, frankly, the older you are, the clearer you are that there are lots of right answers, and the more you value the years you've got. So the question only gets more intense.
Yeah, that's interesting. Staying with you, Dave, if you don't mind, I noticed on your website, both of your websites, the Designing Your Life website, designingyour.life, there's a section there on designing your life for women and actually a course of action there. And I'd be curious actually about some of the nuances you've had or thought of on the application of this for women in particular.
Well, one thing I should point out is neither Bill nor I happen to be a woman.
And consequently, I'm glad you confirmed that.
We have sympathy but not empathy. We do not claim expertise, but we claim interest. Very succinctly, and I'll throw it back to Bill actually to comment further. After we taught at Stanford for a while, and everyone's saying, can I take the class? And we keep saying, well, if you're not one of our 16,000 matriculated students, the answer is no, please don't bother us. We get really tired of saying no. That's why we wrote the book, which just makes the can I take the class question worse. And so we started saying, you know, well, we know, you know, working people don't have 20 hours and 10 weeks to do this thing. Could we get this into a workshop format? So we started experimenting with, you know, half day, one day intensive experiences. Could we pull this thing off in a meaningful way? And in one of our very first summer prototypes, which was just, I think, a 4 or 5 hour prototype, where, you know, it's a friends and family deal, right? We're just kind of reaching out to a couple of people. We happened inadvertently to end up with one of them being all women. And something special was going on in the room. And we went, aha. And then we had noticed this before when we had, like, even a small group, and a group of 60 happens to be all women. Some mojo gets going that's different. And women would not be surprised by this at all. And frankly, neither should men be. Men have a special thing going on too, but less reliably and a little more diversely. But women got really something going on there. And so we said, well, there's something going on there. And one of the women in that group happened to be an incredibly talented chief learning officer named Susan Burnett, who by happenstance is Bill's older sister. But it's not about nepotism. It's just about, you know, smart genes do smart things. And literally, Bill's sister is one of the leading organizational learning experts in the country. So she's been collaborating with us for some time and finally has decided, you know, I think we want to grab that women's mojo thing and go somewhere with it. And that's what you're bumping into. And I'll let Bill speak to what that actually is.
It is quite a special conversation. The head of the D-Life lab here, our managing director, Kathy Davies, and Susan put this together. It's essentially the exact same one-day workshop that Dave and I have taught a number of times, but it takes 2 days and gives us a little bit more time for conversation. One of the things we noticed is that women want to spend some more time talking about these things, and they appreciate giving each other more time to talk about it. I've been in a men's group for many years, and there's a conversation, you know, that men can have when there's no women in the room. It's just a different sort of, you know, sensibility. And certainly when it's all women in the room, the conversation centers more around the work-life balance issue, the family issue. Can I be a successful executive and raise the kids and have it all issue? Kathy and Susan have designed some special exercises that are still design thinking based, but allow people to ideate and prototype into those questions. The conversation is very rich. And what we've discovered when we're doing these things is that women fall into a pretty generative and pretty supportive conversation very quickly. So they want to talk about these things. They want to work on these things. They're emotionally available to have that conversation. And so we just thought, hey, Kathy and Susan would be fantastic facilitators. And they've arranged to have a two-day workshop down to the Sylmar here on the coast in California, just outside of Monterey. The first prototype of that was extraordinary. 97% of the women said, oh, absolutely insist my best friend take this class again. I think we're on to something there. And again, that's just part of the book and workshops and stuff we're doing at Stanford. And we're also transferring the Stanford class out to 14 universities. Next week, we've got Harvard, Yale, MIT, and a bunch of other schools, Dartmouth, and a bunch of other schools coming to learn how to teach the class at their university. And this is all just part of us trying to figure out how to have impact. Class has an impact. If we can get it to lots of other schools, then that'll increase its impact. The workshops, you can pretty much learn all the techniques and really, really embed them in your lifestyle in a pretty intense day-long workshop. And then the book is, you know, the other way to access the information. And our editor tells us we're in a 10th printing, so it's going pretty well. Dave and I just wanted to make sure if the ideas were useful that they would be available to anyone who wanted them.
That's wonderful. Dave, I think you were the one who mentioned that each of you are on the fifth iterations of your careers. And actually what led to this was your own sort of seeking over 43 years, I think you said, in figuring out what to do next. I wonder if each of you, maybe beginning with you, Dave, talk a little bit about how the ideas that you've taught, that you've now written about, that you are facilitating in these day-long sessions, impacted your own lives? How have you used these ideas in your own lives?
Well, I'm just going to an illustration or two. Again, I did it the hard way, and you know, I would have been hugely helped by taking the class we now teach. It was exactly the class I wish we taught, and of course, it didn't do it that way. I think probably where I've been helped is this whole idea of deferring judgment and learning through experimentation rather than analysis. You know, I have two engineering degrees, you know, started in the hard sciences. You know, I like to think, just sit me on a couch in a dark room with my brain turned on and I'll be happy camping for a long time. And so I will tend to think my way into a problem, much less out of it, left to my own devices. And, you know, shut up, defer judgment, don't have a conclusion, understand you've got a bunch of assumptions you haven't even identified yet, you know, all that appropriate step one mindset that design teaches us to have. Now go try some stuff. And try some stuff not with your answer already in mind, like I'm pretty sure I want to be this marine biologist, let me talk to this guy to confirm that I'm right, as opposed to, well, gee, you know, Jacques Cousteau, what's it actually like being a marine biologist? Oh, I don't sleep very much. I spend a lot of time doing incredibly mind-numbing data gathering, mostly points to nothing whatsoever, you know, really listening to what the story really is. And so I think where that has helped me along the way, for instance, when I went in and first started talking with Apple Computer, when they called me and I had promised myself I would not work in the computing industry because it was so boring, then said, well, gee, maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. Let me just hear what these guys have to say. And literally 14 conversations later, to their surprise, they offered me a job. And to my great astonishment, I took it. But that involved a complete reframe of what I thought computing was about, what I thought marketing was about, what I thought the workplace was about, and what I thought the mission of my life was about. I had to do about four significant reorientation. And I had to give myself permission to do that. And I wouldn't have done that if I hadn't been able to listen to 14 people tell 14 stories without me already knowing the answer. So it can have a huge effect. If I had, you know, stuck with what I was doing, I'd right now simply be a completely frustrated, totally ineffectual, and reasonably poor, as opposed to a guy that got to do some interesting work in technology.
Bill, same question.
When we first sat down to plan this class, I don't like self-help stuff. I'm not a self-help guide. I asked the editor if we could make it a design book, and she said, no, no one buys design books. It's going to be a self-help book. But for me, Dave and I first sat down to talk about this. I said, look, you know, teaching a class where we're sort of helping people figure out their lives, we have to do this stuff too, or we're going to be the biggest hypocrites on the campus. And so I practice almost everything, you know, at one level or another that we have in the book. I do an affirmation practice in the morning, a gratefulness practice. Design thinking is just the way I'm a designer my entire career. So that was just an embedded, you know, kind of mindset. But noticing how I can prototype even life experiences or life ideas, redeveloping that idea in my own life and thinking of things as prototypes. The idea of prototyping, the idea of sort of positive psychology, idea of what you pay attention to is how you experience the world. So pay attention to gratefulness, pay attention to flow state. The more I work on the sort of psychology of flow, the more I discover myself in, you know, fabulous flow state. I'm a pretty big user of all the tools in the book. You know, I'm not saying that makes it any more authentic or less authentic, but it makes me convinced these things actually work outside of just what we know from research, that they work for me personally. And, you know, we get a lot of calls back from students 2, 3, 4 years out now, 5 years, even seven, well, a few that are 7 years who took the very first class, who've seen the book, and they said, you know, I'm still using my Odyssey plan. I'm still prototyping ideas for my life. You know, this stuff has really been useful. Before the book, we used to get the report that, hey, my friends are really confused, so I'm teaching them stuff from the class. Can you send me the slides? It's quite gratifying. And again, I'm sort of humbling that people are finding this stuff useful. But we know it works. I know it works. I use it all the time.
That's great. I can only imagine how gratifying that must be. Bill Burnett, Dave Evans, thank you so much, both of you, for joining me. Thank you also for a terrific book, Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived, Joyful Life. It's been great speaking with you both.
Thanks very much, Peter.
Fortinet, the global leader in high-performance cybersecurity solutions, is a proud sponsor of the Forum on World-Class IT. The Fortinet Security Fabric delivers the broad, powerful, and automated protections today's organizations require to secure their evolving networks, from IoT to the cloud. Learn more at fortinet.com. Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever source you use for podcasts. And please join us next week when my guest will be Chris Corrado, the Chief Operating Officer and Chief Information Officer of the London Stock Exchange Group. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World-Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World-Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World-Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' 5 principles of world-class IT. The 5 principles are as follows. Principle 1 is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the 3 prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The 5th and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the 4th principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.